Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. This week, I'm joined by Amita Jesse, a consultant clinical psychologist who works at the UK's only specialist service for body dysmorphic disorder. Amita is also a trustee for the Body Dysmorphic Disorder Foundation, and I was so excited to speak to her with somebody with so much passion and experience for raising awareness about body dysmorphic disorder. In this episode, we touch all on the different stigmas that exist, the support that's required, and what needs to change in order to give people the treatment that they require and deserve.
Hi, Anna.
So it's so lovely to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. It was so funny when I will shout at George for the rest of my life for not properly introducing me to you, because we were just stood there and I was like,
I know.
Surely he's going to introduce me in a moment. But then I said to him afterwards and he was like, I just assumed that you were so friendly. I assumed you already knew her.
I know, and I didn't know when to sort of, I felt so rude because I was like, I haven't introduced her, I'm just talking. But yeah, it was a very busy day. So
it was
lovely
to meet
you in person. But yeah.
Yeah, it was a really brilliant day, I thought. And I did a lot of reflection after the event because I've struggled with body dysmorphia myself. And when I originally was asked to go, I thought, oh, you know, that's going to be hard. Being in a room where the topic's being discussed a lot, and it was hard, like it brought forward a lot of emotions, but it was equally so wonderful to meet people that have had a similar experience and to meet people like yourself that are putting in so much work to sort of understand what's going on behind body dysmorphia and you know how that impacts people's lives. So overall it was such a wonderful day.
Yeah, I totally can understand that. I think it is a mixture of emotions, isn't it? Mm. And I think we made sure we had space, kind of like breakout rooms where people could just have a bit of time to themselves and support. And because we just think people are so brave sort of coming to those events. And, you know, it's really, leaving themselves really vulnerable to what they might hear or talk to other people about. But yeah, I'm really pleased overall it felt positive.
Yeah, no, it did. And I guess just for the listeners, do you want to just introduce yourself and the work that you do to give a bit of an overview before we start the conversation?
Yeah, of course. So I'm Amita Jesse and I'm a consultant clinical psychologist, and I lead the only service that exists, unfortunately, for body dysmorphic disorder for young people. So we're one of very few in the world actually that really focus in on the disorder, but particularly young people. We know BDD often develops in adolescence, so it's a real shame there's not more services out there for people with BDD. So that's my sort of clinical work. So I assess and treat young people with body dysmorphic disorder and OCD and other related conditions. And part of my role is also to lead on research in the field on behalf of the team. And also we do lots of teaching and training well to kind of upskill other clinicians and just raise awareness. I do quite a bit of media work just to be getting BDD on the map and so people know what it is. And then I guess in my other role, I'm a trustee of the BDD Foundation, which is the only charity that exists for BDD, which is what we were talking about earlier, the conference that we put on. It was last year now, but yeah, so I'm a trustee on the charity, which is a fantastic role, really fulfilling. Very small charity, but do amazing work. So that's me.
Yeah, it is amazing. And it, you know, it's really sad to hear that, you know, you're one of the only services. There's BDD, which is the only charity, but equally, you know, I'm so grateful that those services and those charities do exist because I think, like you alluded to, both of them are working to raise awareness. And I think often BDD is a massively misunderstood diagnosis, which is hopefully what we're going to talk about today and debunk a lot of stigmas that people might have. So I guess to start with, would you be able to explain what BDD is?
Yeah, so I'll give the kind of definition that we use in clinics, but of course, you know, I'll try and bring it to life as much as I can with sort of the real life experience. But the diagnostic definition of body dysmorphic disorder is when somebody is really preoccupied and distressed by a perceived flaw in their appearance. And the word perceived is quite important because for that person, they see that flaw, but to other people they might not really notice it, or they might think it's really slight and it doesn't sort of need that preoccupation. But there's lots of distress and preoccupation, and associated with that then people engage in lots of repetitive behaviors, as we call them in the clinic. But basically they're just means to try and hide or fix or try and camouflage this perceived flaw or flaws in their appearance. So for example, it could be things like camouflaging with makeup, so doing particular things with makeup to change features on the face or to hide features. So if somebody's really preoccupied with their skin, sort of trying to cover that up, camouflaging with clothes and so forth. There's behaviours like checking in the mirror, kind of checking over and over or avoiding mirrors. They could be seeking reassurance from other people, either in person or in social media. I mean, the list is endless, but they're all means of trying to reduce that distress and try and hide or fix those perceived flaws. And I've sort of used the word flaw and flaws, but it's often more than one area of concern. And most people are worried about sort of facial features because there's quite a lot on the face. It can be any part of the body, and it could be, you know, anything from things that people can see more of, like face, or it could be something that's quite private, like genitalia and kind of, you know, different parts of the body that might be covered up. But it literally can be anything. And for some people, it can be really fixated on particular sort of perceived flaws, and some people also have a sense of just my features don't quite fit well together, it doesn't quite look right, I'm not symmetrical, I'm grotesque, I'm ugly. So it can also be those broader themes, but it's a really distressing condition that is often overlooked and missed in clinical sort of practice.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting condition. And I think the sort of misunderstanding around it kind of comes from, because it is associated with the way that you look and your reflection in the mirror, I think people often think, oh, you know, you're just kind of self-obsessed, or, you know, really kind of almost in love with yourself, which is actually the complete opposite of what somebody will experience. And I think often, it's almost, I think people underestimate the impact that it kind of can have on your life. And from my personal experience, so I've had anorexia. And so I thought that my BDD was sort of an element of my eating disorder. But then when I was diagnosed with BDD, I started to think about the other elements of my body that I was very preoccupied with. And some of them were very weight centric.
Yeah.
Then I also, like, I'm not so much now, but I used to be very obsessed with the shape of my eyebrows and would like see a completely distorted view of my eyebrows. And, you know, I'd say to my parents or, you know, my partner, like, they look completely different, and they'd be like, there's like, you know, if there is a difference, it's so slight. But for me, it was in every single picture, every single mirror, I had to check it. And I think when you explain that to people, they're like, but their eyebrows, what's your problem? Yeah. But actually the distress that caused because of the worry and the anxiety around it, I think for so many people that can be crippling in terms of the impact it has on you.
Exactly. And I think you've picked up on a couple of things that I didn't sort of say. It is the distress and impact that's the kind of defining feature of BDD and many other conditions. So, you know, many of us might have parts of our appearance that we don't particularly like, or things that when we look in the mirror, like, oh, you know. And I think that's maybe why BDD is often kind of, people get worried about sharing about it, because it's, yeah, it can be dismissed, like, oh, we all worry about our appearance and so forth. But actually, it's more than that, and it's about sort of what you see and the distress it causes, and then the measures that people take to try and hide or fix it. So it's definitely the distress and anxiety. And I think it often is hard for other people to sort of understand that, because like you said with your example, other people look at you and think, well, what are you talking about? But you see, or you saw what you know, you saw in the mirror in the photos. And so in treatment and assessments, we ask young people to draw a picture of themselves if they can. Mm-hmm. So we can really see in their mind's eye what they can see, because it's not about us saying, well, no, we can't see that, so therefore it's not true. It's like, no, that's how somebody perceives themselves, and it's really distressing. Mm-hmm. So it's often a really good way for us to understand what in their mind's eye, what do they see in the mirror? Because perception has a huge impact on all of us, and we all perceive things in different ways, and so that's the person's perception of themselves, and that's the important thing.
Yeah. Is there any like research or understanding as to why somebody's perception of themselves could be either like such an important factor to them, or is maybe very skewed as to what is actually like what they actually look like?
It's a really good question. There is lots of research, but no conclusions from that. I think there's so many different theories about, I guess I'm particularly thinking about BDD and how that develops and why some people see themselves a certain way, you know, versus others. And I think there's just so many different factors that come into play. So we know from research that some of these conditions can run in families, but that's not to say it's genetic. And so if, you know, somebody has BDD and they have a child, then that child will have BDD. It's not as simple as that. It's just, it might be somewhere in the family history, coupled with things around sort of the way the brain is structured and the neurochemistry. And we know that because, for example, some medications can be helpful for body dysmorphic disorder, but they don't cure it. So we know that's not the full answer. And then I guess as a psychologist, I'm particularly interested when I'm working with somebody about life experiences. And some people have had some really tricky and difficult life experiences, and often sort of bullying and commentary on sort of appearance comes up when I'm talking to people I'm working with, where it might not even be as extreme as bullying, but just the importance of appearance being fed into somebody as they've been growing up, sort of messages from all sorts of sources about the importance of appearance, and therefore that becomes something that sort of distress gets hooked into. But lots of different areas of research, but not any conclusions, and I think we just don't really know the reason for that. There's some other research about sort of people being more attention and sort of detail focused, and they're more likely to develop BDD. But again, I have to say, every single young person I meet in the clinic is really different, and you know, there's some clusters. I'm like, oh yeah, that reminds me of that person, they went that way, and then there'll be another cluster. It's just such a heterogeneous condition, like many conditions, and people have got different life stories, come from all different backgrounds, and there's not much research, but there is some cross-cultural research to show that the rates of BDD are broadly similar across different cultures, so there's something in that as well.
It's just always really interested me, because I think, you know, there's definitely that element of, you know, maybe some people appearance is more important to them, or there may have been comments about their appearance. But I just find it fascinating that, you know, one day I can look in the mirror and look a certain way, and then 30 seconds later I'll look completely different. And to me, I mean, that's got to be more than maybe just like my values or my experiences. I feel, and you know, I've not done any research on this, so this is purely my biased opinion, that that's got to be something in my brain that is sending sort of like a distorted message from maybe my eyes to my brain as to what it is seeing. And I think also with that, when I first got diagnosed with BDD, it was kind of like, oh, well, that makes sense. That makes sense why, you know, things look so different from one second to the next. But equally, I was terrified, because then I was like, okay, well, if my reflection or the way that I see myself is not the way that everybody else sees me, what on earth do I look like? And because my appearance was such a big part of my personality, and like it mattered so much to me, it was then like, well, what on earth do I look like if I can't see what I actually look like?
It's such a great insight into that. And I do wonder whether sort of the particular thoughts in that moment, or sort of distress or anxiety, all sort of play a role in perception. So totally, I get what you're saying about sort of what the eye sees and then what processes then in the brain and what you get back. But I guess in the work we do find that maybe it's more like a particular thought comes into the mind, a judgment, or just how we're sort of feeling that day can then really impact on perception. So even moment to moment, that can change. And I guess also in BDD, often people do lots and lots of check-in And I think that can reinforce the cycle, because if I sort of did that, even that process, it makes you doubt, and then you see more detail, and then you're like, is that spot there, is it not? And then if you keep focusing, that can also affect your perception as well. So it's a bit of a vicious cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. I distinctly remember one of my friends who studied psychology at uni, she said to me, the problem with that like ritualistic checking behavior is if you sat and stared at a wall and said to yourself, there's a dot on that wall.
Yeah.
If you sat there for hours and hours and hours telling yourself there's a dot on that wall, by the end, there's going to be a dot on that wall, because you've told yourself so much that there's a dot on the wall. So if you keep, checking and checking and checking for something that you think is there and that you're worried is there, your brain is a very interesting thing, and it probably will start to see things that kind of aren't there. And I also think, the point that you meant about the the detail focus, I think that is like a really interesting thing that I've read about, in terms of focusing on one very specific area of your body, and really if you do that, then that element of that of your body is going to feel larger or feel different to the rest of your body, because it's the only thing that you're looking at, rather than seeing yourself on a whole and how all your proportions fit together.
Exactly. And some of the work that we do in treatment is we do mirror retraining, and it's kind of something I do with everybody, actually, and it's exactly what you're talking about there. So often when people look in the mirror or on their phone, when they're sort of looking at their appearance, they will zoom into the areas that they don't like and kind of keep checking and checking, and there'll be lots of like internal commentary and lots of negative sort of judgments about it. And then what we do is just one of many different techniques in treatment, but we'll ask people to kind of step away from the mirror, see themselves as a whole, and just objectively go through their body from head to toe. And it's really hard, because I often demonstrate it and I find it really difficult as well. So we always do it with people and kind of support them to practice. But what we then get them to do is just go, as I said, from head to toe, just describe really objectively, as if they were asking somebody, describing themselves to like an alien who doesn't even know what a human being is, and just going through their body and trying to disengage from that negative commentary and just see themselves as a whole. And rather than just kind of their eyebrows or their skin or their, the shape of their lips or whatever it may be. And, that in itself is not going to make all the difference, but it just tries to get the brain to kind of engage differently with the mirror and not to kind of zoom in on the bit that really sort of caused the distress and are the sort of focus of attention. But it's hard work, and it's hard not to kind of, I do it, I straight away go to the areas that I'm not particularly keen on, because it's natural. So if you have BDD, it's going to be sort of 1,000 times worse, but it's quite a useful technique.
Yeah, and I think in society as well, it's very common to focus on your perceived flaws rather than the things that you actually like about yourself. It's almost, if you started talking about all the stuff you liked about you, people would be like, what the hell? Whereas it's almost normalized to say, oh, I don't like this, I don't like that, which it should be the complete opposite. But unfortunately it isn't. But I guess with that, you mentioned like, that is not the only technique that you use, and that's not going to kind of cure the BDD. What sort of other things do you do in treatment to support somebody with BDD?
Yeah, so there's two recommended treatments for BDD. So one is cognitive behavioural therapy, which is a psychological treatment, and the other is medication. And the medications that we use for BDD are antidepressants, but often at higher doses than you would use for depression. Mm-hmm. And typically we'd always try the psychological treatment first, and then you add in the medication if people are struggling with the treatment and just need a bit more help. So CBT encompasses lots of different techniques. I'm sure many people know that. But ultimately, the work that we do, and I'm focusing more on young people, but I'm sure this is true for adults as well, is you first spend time sort of learning about body dysmorphic disorder, distress. And also, I guess the really important thing is people understanding and developing a formulation, a sort of a map of how they think they're BDD works, but also what might have led to them developing these appearance concerns. So that's where, I mentioned different stories that I hear. It can range from anything, from actual people making positive comments about appearance, but just growing up in an environment where, positive comments were made and they had to live to that, to bullying to not even anything about appearance, just always feeling different. So I work with lots of autistic people and they say, well, I've never fit in, I've always been different. So you're sort of getting a sense from somebody there about some of their beliefs about the world and themselves and others. And then as part of that roadmap, we're kind of mapping out sort of how their BGD works. And we think about the here and now. So kind of what happens on a day-to-day sort of basis. So in a nutshell, kind of what is keeping the problem going in the here and now. And that's really helpful because then that helps us think about what we do in treatment. So typically, and this is how I work, but other therapists might work slightly differently, I would start with the things that are kind of easier to change and behaviours that might be easier to drop or kind of reduce, because that will just take the sting out of that cycle. So for an example, we've been talking a lot about mirrors. So, you know, I might want somebody understands the cycle of BDD and understands how it works and how they got there, I might say, well, why don't we try and, well, come up with their goals first. And if this is one of their goals, try and sort of think, well, yes, just cut down sort of mirror checking and try that step by step. So I guess I would start by that. Some of the, it's quite a behavioural approach, I guess, particularly with young people to start with, to try and reduce down some of those behaviours, just to take some of the sort of the distress out of it and reduce what they can reduce. Then that's kind of the main thing we would use. And we do experiments as well. So some people call it exposure, some people call it behavior experiments. But ultimately, it's coming down to the same thing where you're testing something out. Either it's dropping some of these behaviors that might just keep that cycle going, or doing an experiment. So people might have strong beliefs that if they don't wear all the makeup that they've got and sort of wear a face mask and a hood on, that people will notice them and point at them and they might sort of notice their flaws. So we would do careful experiments to test that out together. So we'd always do this with people in the clinic. And that's aimed really at testing out some of their beliefs, because often people will have really strong beliefs about, well, people will notice my skin and they will laugh and point, or, you know, I'm going to be too distressed, I won't be able to cope. So we try to tap into those beliefs and test them out. Because I guess if you keep doing those behaviours, you never get to know if it actually would happen. That fear consequence is a bit of a, yeah, it's a bit of a, not a catch-22, but yeah, it's like you just wouldn't know unless you did something differently. But we do this really carefully and always in collaboration. Mm. So that's kind of the bulk of the treatment. But then, you know, as I mentioned, we do other things. So if they've got, you know, finding it really hard, say if we said, right, we're going to try and work on mirrors and try and reduce it, they're finding that really hard, might do some mirror retraining to support them with that. We also do lots of work around sort of thoughts, and they're having particular thoughts, you know, particular themes of thoughts, like, you know, self-critical thoughts and so forth. We might work on those. If people have had quite traumatic experiences, and that does happen, where they've had really difficult experiences that are really difficult to process, we may do some work in thinking about the past in a bit more detail and doing something called imagery rescripting, where they're sort of trying to kind of go over these difficult memories, reflect on them and see, look back at them and rescript them in a different way to help them sort of process them. So often people can be really self-critical, think they should have done something different in situations, or it was their fault, and you're sort of then challenging some of those beliefs and being more compassionate with themselves when they're looking back at those memories. And I guess that is a theme, I think, of treatment, is a real compassion-focused kind of emphasis. And I know colleagues in adult work do lots of compassion-focused work weaved in, you know, with the CBT, and that's key as well, because just having that compassion for oneself is so important in this work. But, you know, we've got good treatments. They're always improving. There's always scope to kind of improve things, but it can be any kind of number of different techniques. But I guess if you're getting good CBT or BDD, then you should be seen weekly, and it should involve doing some experiments or trying to challenge some of the kind of behaviours or the thoughts in session with your therapist, and then doing some of that work outside of treatment is really important. So you should be set homework, because often people will come to us in our clinic, as we're specialist clinic, people have been through quite a lot to get to us, and they said, well, I've had CBT for BDD, and when you hear about it, it's like, oh, it hasn't got the active components that we know that really help, and that's often then leads people to believe it doesn't work, when actually we know it does. But it's important, it's got some exposure work and some behavioural experiments included in it.
One thing I wanted to ask you about was, You were talking there about like the ritualistic behaviors and sort of, you know, the way to navigate that is almost to prove yourself wrong in terms of, you know, because I think a lot of the time ritualistic behaviors, at least in my experience, they exist because you start a behavior and then you start to believe that if you don't do that behavior, like something bad is going to happen, whatever kind of that bad thing is going to happen. But then because it's so ingrained in you and you've done that behavior repetitively, now you can't break out of that behavior. And that has definitely been my experience. But I guess my question was, because when you spoke at the start and you said about OCD as well, and so is BDD, the kind of ritualistic behaviors, is that similar to those observed in OCD, or are they quite different?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because actually what I should have said at the beginning as well is that BDD has moved around a little bit in the sort of diagnostic manual that we use, and it's now been put in the family of OCD and related disorders for exactly that reason, because they think there's quite a lot of overlap between the different those two conditions. And I think exactly what you said there, Hannah, one of those is the ritualistic behaviours, and I guess also the thoughts that precede that. So I guess in OCD, what you're more likely to get is like intrusive thoughts. So they're kind of thoughts that pop into your head, they're really distressing, and they can be about anything. They could be about sort of religious, sexual, you know, contamination, checking, you know, worrying about something bad happening. And then the repetitive behaviours are there to kind of stop that bad thing from happening. And they're sort of really, as ritualistic and repetitive. And they're sort of aimed at reducing distress and trying to stop that bad thing from happening. And it is quite similar in BDD. I guess the quality of the thoughts that you might get in BDD are a bit different. So I would describe them as more like preoccupation. So they're not just like pop in and then you do something. It's more like, it's always, you know, you just get really preoccupied, they're in your mind. In OCD, I sort of describe it almost like it's like popcorn going off in your head, like they sort of the thoughts pop in and then you're doing something to try and stop that bad thing happening in that moment. But I think with BDD, what people have described to me, it feels a bit different. Like it's not like you get intrusive thought and then you do something, it's more like you're preoccupied and then you'll go to the mirror. But exactly what you said there, sort of the ritualistic behaviors are a safety behavior. They're there to try and keep you safe, and in BDD that could be for any number of reasons. It could be that fear of kind of being judged by others or seeing yourself and being so distressed, or that feared outcome can be lots of different things. So they are quite closely related, and often we'll see people that have both in the clinic, or they sort of go on to develop the other one. I mean, there's lots of different thoughts. Some people think BDD is actually more like eating disorders because of the focus on sort of body image and kind of and though, you know, having difficulties in that area. So there's a bit of a debate, but I guess I work in that in a clinic that sees both, so I feel like that does fit. But there are some things that do feel different between BDD and OCD too.
I suppose, like, because I, before I sort of looked into it further, when I just knew about my experience, I definitely thought that BDD was an eating disorder. But then since exploring it further, like, and like you said at the start, you know, people can experience that with any part of their body. So it could be something on their face, it can be their genitalia, it can be sort of something to do with their body and a weight centric thing. But I think in instances where it's maybe related to somebody's body and they're, you know, trying to manipulate their weight because of the body dysmorphia, then, you know, I'd say that that does align with an eating disorder. But equally, people will have experiences that they're not kind of trying to change their diet or manipulate their weight in order to navigate their BDD.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there is a, in the criteria, there is, if in the BDD criteria, that if it's just shape and weight concerns, that that's more likely to be an eating disorder. Of course, people can have both and can have things about, it's quite interesting in the clinics, we often have that dilemma, because some people will have things about like their tummy not being flat and sort of hips and things that you would see as more kind of, you're more likely to hear in the eating disorder clinic. But I think ultimately for us, the question is, does our treatment, do we think there's anything in our treatment that can support that person? So for me, sort of labels and where it fits is helpful because it's a bit of a shortcut. But ultimately, I think, well, is there anything in our treatment that we think could help this person sort of overcome their difficulties. And I think also, I think if it's somebody who is struggling with eating and you know, their physical health, then that would trump everything and that would be prioritized. So I think sometimes it's so interesting, it depends who you talk to and, you know, and where they sit. But I think for me, that's the ultimate thing. You know, labels are helpful, but it's about what can be done to help and what guides that. Often is diagnostic labels, but I think it's more hearing the experience of a person. People don't fit into these neat boxes.
No.
People don't just have one, you know, we're human beings at the end of the day. And it's about, yeah, finding ways to support people to overcome their difficulties with the techniques that we have. And that's, yeah, the ultimate goal, really. Yeah.
I love that you said that, because I think there is such a, you know, pool of thought that we can all fit into these boxes. And I know that diagnostic criteria can help, whether that's sort of defining the treatment or, you know, giving the validation to the person or just, you know, giving some sort of answer. But equally, from my perspective, you know, just because I've got a certain diagnosis doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to respond to the treatment.
So it's
really important, like you say, to look at the individual. And also what you were just saying about sort of, you know, if it's weight focused or whatever, then it might be an eating disorder. I think another factor that I always thought about as well is, you know, if somebody's in restriction or if they're underweight or something like that, they're probably going to have a starved brain and therefore their kind of perception of self is skewed anyway. So I think in that instance, you know, then it's really important to take that into consideration and maybe, you know, work on the nutrition side of things and getting up somebody to regular eating or to a healthy weight before you start to then explore their body image and the way that they see themselves.
Definitely. And I did some research years ago on a very small number of young people, but it was an OCD and it was exactly that. We sort of looked at treatment outcomes for those that were deemed underweight or weren't sort of getting nutrition that they needed. So as you said, the starved brain, and just compared to a small group that sort of had similar symptoms but were sort of healthy weight. And actually the outcomes for CBT were compromised by the physical sort of health side of things, which sounds really obvious, but I guess it came out of some work I was doing with a young person where another clinician was saying, well, you need to work on the OCD. And I was saying, well, they're underweight, you know, they're not able to engage it. And also, yeah, you know, it's just going to be really difficult treatment because it was just the rigidity of thinking and so forth was really making it hard and they were barely eating. And so I was like, well, need some research on this. It seemed really obvious sort of from a clinical perspective, and it was nice to be able to kind of demonstrate that. But so in our service, we do recommend that, that if somebody wants to undertake some psychological treatment for OCD or BDD, we do have a look at sort of their physical health. So not just weight, but just, you know, their diet and just generally how they are and whether they are able to engage, because we want to give people the best chance of sort of getting the best from the treatment.
Yeah, but yeah, absolutely.
I can completely relate to that with people I've worked with where they're so unwell in terms of their physical health that just thinking about, you know, things from a psychological perspective is really tough.
Yeah, absolutely. And one more question before we come on to the treatment and the work that you guys do in your clinic, because I just think that this is another important thing to do in to chat about in terms of raising awareness and the stigma associated with BDD. We spoke about it a little bit before in terms of like the impact that the thoughts and the preoccupation can have, but I just wanted to explore a bit more about the impact that it has on somebody's life and you know, the experiences that you've had with your patients in terms of, does it have a big impact on, you know, like money or people's job or their social life and that kind of thing?
All of the above. Yeah, it has a huge impact. Of course, it varies. And, you know, I should sort of caveat this by saying I do see people quite, you know, at the end of the spectrum where they've like had treatment before, they're quite unwell. So the way our service works is they have to have been seen in their local services before they access specialists. So it is quite a skewed sample. But having said that, we've done some research with the only other sort of clinic that we know that works with young people, and they see more of a kind of range, so they don't see the more severe end. And in terms of young people, and I'm assuming this is the same in terms of adults, but about a third of them are not accessing education and they're housebound because they're so distressed. And even during the pandemic, you know, that was really tough because having things online, having the camera on, I mean, it's literally a mirror all the time.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, been really difficult for lots of our young people. So they really struggle with that. So it just has that huge impact. And I guess also in other ways, in terms of sort of just functional impairment, in terms of, you know, relationships with family and kind of the distress in sort of family relationships is quite tough. There's sort of impact in other ways, and the really sort of sad truth about BDD is that there's really high rates of kind of self-harm and sort of suicidality in this group. And so people get quite desperate and feel sort of that there's no other way out, really. And you mentioned kind of money, and I guess just on that point, people will often be seeking lots of procedures. So I'm not talking about surgery, even just getting products from the high street, you know, buying lots and lots of makeup or getting procedures like Botox and so forth. You know, they can end up in debt because they're sort of trying to fix something that, you know, we would deem as a psychological problem, but with physical kind of means, and never feeling satisfied. And so that can spiral out of control. And of course, again, I know I work with young people, but I've heard stories where, you know, young people got so desperate that they've stolen money from some parents and things just to fund kind of buying, it might not even be Botox, just things like eyelashes and, you know, makeup and different ways to camouflage in terms of clothes and so forth. So it can have an impact in lots of different ways in terms of education, occupation, relationship with others. So often people feel like they can't develop relationships with others. We've had also the opposite, where people get into risky situations in relationships, trying to get that validation from somebody, and ending up in situations where if they felt a bit better about themselves, they might not get into. So really vulnerable in both kind of directions, I would say. And just, yeah, I think across the board, I think it just impacts social life, people not going out, or lots of people maybe using drugs and alcohol as a way to self-medicate. You know, so I've had lots of people that I've worked with that say, well, the only way I can go out to that party is if I get really drunk beforehand, and again, leaving themselves vulnerable. So, yeah, it's really, really sad. I mean, there is the other end of the spectrum where it might not be, you know, it might be milder. But I just think, if you know somebody who's got BDD, or you think they might, they're just going through an awful lot, you know, just to even do day-to-day things that we, you know, that people without BDD might find relatively easy, like going on a call online, a meeting, you know, for somebody with BDD, that could be like the worst possible thing. They might miss things at work, they might have their camera off and be deemed to be not partaking, you know, just any day-to-day thing. They're just so worried about appearance and being judged by others. So, yeah, the list can go on. It's really sad, just the devastating impact it can have on people.
Yeah, I suppose that's the horrible cycle, isn't it? Of like, you know, you worry that people are going to judge you based on the way that you look. So you withdraw, whether that's from social situations or from work or whatever. And then you have that isolation and that loneliness, and then increased judgment because you're now not going to things. And it's just a perpetual cycle. And then you worry, oh, people haven't seen me for a while, so maybe I've changed, or because you don't have that exposure to people seeing you, it then increases it. And something that I wanted to ask you about, because it's something I've been really interested in for quite a while, especially when it comes to BDD, is, you know, a lot of people that I have heard about or know about will have procedures in order to change things, the way that they look, because of their BDD. But it may not be that when they were going for the procedure, they knew that it was BDD. Mm. And I just wonder, do you think there's a responsibility there of people that are providing those procedures to almost do like a psychological check to make sure that somebody isn't struggling, you know, with their mental health? Because I think, I mean, I don't know really where I draw the line, because, you know, often people will go for the procedure because they feel insecure about an element of their body, and they think that by changing that, it will feel, they'll feel better.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think, you know, maybe initially they might feel better, but in my perspective, and I haven't had any procedures, but this has been my perspective with the anorexia and the weight loss, is like you change something and think that'll make you feel better, but actually you don't even then kind of notice it, because you then have another thing that you want to change about yourself. And I think even in people that maybe don't have BDD, there can become that sort of, you know, almost chasing the dragon of like, well, I've changed that thing, so now I need to change another thing. But yeah, going back to my original question about a psychological almost screening, I guess, do you think that that's necessary?
We've been trying for years, Hannah. This is something really that we've been working. Yeah, I think it's so tricky. So there's been different phases. So I know a few years back, maybe about 5 years, there was something from NHS England to say, you know, people should be screened. So I think there was particularly some focus. Yeah, quite some time ago. It comes in peaks and troughs, but I think high street brands that I won't mention were able to offer Botox, and they then called on us at the foundation and also kind of different professionals in who are expert in BDD to say, should they not be screening? And it's like, yes, they should. And so there was, you know, we did lots of work around that. And then I guess a lot of us try and do some educating with cosmetic surgeons, just so they're mindful of that. And I think it's a really mixed bag in terms of the response that we get. But ideally, it would be great to have psychological screening. I guess if people want to get procedures, they might know what to say and might, you know, find ways around it. And you're right, I think in our experience of those that we do know have BDD, they're unlikely to be satisfied, or satisfied in the short term, and then it moves around, or they find something else about that particular feature that they now don't like. So it's basically just another repetitive behavior, and it's a short-term kind of makes you feel better. And I guess what's dangerous about cosmetic procedures is just all of the medical side of it, and just the, you know, that you've actually changed something that feels very different. But I think, yeah, there is a responsibility, I guess, for all professionals, because what we also know that I haven't mentioned is we're not seeing a fraction of those with BDD, and it's not because of the services, it's because they're going elsewhere. So they're going to cosmetic clinicians, they're going to the high street, they're, you know, to get the procedures, or they're buying products. They're not being seen in mental health services, because the very nature of the condition is that people truly believe it's a problem with their physical appearance. So why would they come to mental health services? Because it's not a mental health problem. You know, so one of the hallmarks of BDD is kind of what we call insight, that it's really poor in terms of people don't see it as a psychological problem, which is, yeah, that's just the hallmark of this particular condition. So I guess that is another part of this, is that actually that responsibility of screening, not just so then it might support people to make a different decision, but also if they're screened in an environment that we know they're going to rather than coming to us, then they'll get picked up more. But it's a massive battle. It's been going on for years, even before I came into the field. You know, it's an ongoing battle, and there's so many different layers to what makes it difficult. But the sad truth is that most people will be there, you know, with BDD rather than being seen in our services. And unfortunately, I mean, things like this are amazing because it's raising awareness, and we hope that people are listening and might think, oh, that might be me, and you know, there is support out there. But if people don't know it's BDD and they do think it's, you know, their physical appearance, then it's really tricky, isn't it, for them to get the right support. And they might go through lots of these procedures, and you know, until it becomes very apparent that it's not working. And often they come to our attention after that, when they've tried these things and it's not worked, and they're still really distressed, or things, unfortunately, like the self-harm or suicidality and the risk that often brings them to mental health attention. And that's sad, because if it's, you know, people knew more about it and thought it might be BDD and get the appropriate support, then it might not get to that stage. So, yeah, so sorry, that was a bit of a rant.
It's
a very hot topic, but I just think...
Yeah,
I think we've all got a responsibility for that. I think.
Yeah, and I suppose because you literally said what I was going to say when you said, you know, whilst the screening might not prevent someone having it, if you know, because they might say things to get around it or whatever. If that's the place where people are going rather than going to a mental health service, if you could, you know, just flutter the idea, or, you know, say to somebody like, are you sure that this isn't, you know, something that is a mental health condition, or maybe not phrase it like that, but, you know, how much of an impact is this having on you and things like that, then so many people could get help through being in the places. Yeah. And I was also thinking as well, you know, how we were speaking about a lot of people think that BDD is associated with eating disorders. Maybe that's because people are, you know, I would assume that more people get support from an eating disorder. Therefore, they're in the service, and then that's also being picked up. Whereas if somebody's just got BDD and it's not related to an eating disorder, probably less likely to, like you said, be in a mental health service. They're probably going to be going into a salon or wherever to get a procedure. So if you could get people there, and just sort of, you know, say this is the support that's available if this is something that's having an impact on you, I think that would be really beneficial.
Definitely. And I guess the way we're sort of trying to do this, particularly at the foundation, the BDD Foundation, is all the work sort of with media to really sort of raise awareness more broadly. And I know, you know, particular gyms have taken that on board, and they're sort of thinking about sort of with muscle dysmorphia and just that array sort of awareness raising. We do lots of teaching and training. So what you said there about, you know, there might be mental health services already, surprisingly it gets missed in mental health services. So I'm sort of saying, oh, if they could get to us, you know, great. But I was, probably was thinking more sort of services that are geared up to BDD, but often, particularly in young people, it might get missed. So it might get misdiagnosed. So people think, oh, it's social anxiety, it's an eating disorder. It could be that a lot of appearance worries, I think you sort of alluded to it earlier, it might get dismissed a little bit, particularly if somebody can't see what you're kind of, you're talking about, or they might just think, oh, well, you're an adolescent, or everybody worries about their appearance. And so often, you know, people dismiss it. And then I think you said it earlier as well, just about the sort of sense that people might feel like they're vain, or they're self-conceited, or they might feel shame and embarrassment about sort of saying, do you know what, I think about my sort of appearance quite a lot. So there's lots of barriers, I think, to people kind of sharing it. And I think that's what, you know, today and other, like your podcast is about, is about dispelling those myths. And, you know, it's a really common condition, so it's just as common as OCD, and everybody, most people know about OCD. So we think, you know, 2% of the population have BDD, which doesn't sound like much, but compared to other conditions, you know, it is. And if we just think in a school environment, for example, you know, if a year group has got 100, there's at least two, there'll be one other person if you've got it, or if you're on a bus, I don't know what the bus capacity is, but, you know, it's really common. But yeah, the fact that OCD and BDD are just as common, but if you think about what people know about each of those, it's just completely, like, there's a mismatch completely. So really common, gets missed for all sorts of reasons, and that's why it's really important. Everybody talks about it in lots of different ways to kind of raise that awareness, and screening, as you said as well.
Talk about it in all different ways, but in factual ways, not you know, the self-obsessive way. And I think you mentioned muscle dysmorphia as well there, and I think that is a really good example of, you know, because I think it's muscle dysmorphia, is that like in the category of body dysmorphia?
Yeah, it's seen as a subtype, and I guess it's particularly around, you know, seeing yourself as more sort of slight, not muscular enough. So it's about sort of more the body shape, and kind of, or seeing themselves as kind of not lean enough, and so forth. So yeah, it's seen as a subtype of body dysmorphic disorder.
But even with that, you know, I think when people think of muscle dysmorphia, they think about the, you know, the lad down the gym who's always at the gym and prioritizes the gym and can't stop looking at himself in the mirror and keeps taking pictures and things like that. And I think people's like immediate response is, you know, self-obsessed, really like obsessed with their image and all of that. And actually, it's the complete opposite of that. I mean, I guess it, you know, it is obsession around the body image, but not in the way of like, oh, I'm so good looking or anything like that. It's everything that they perceive is wrong and all of that. And I, there are so many barriers, I think, and particular with the sort of stigma associated with it. But just to finish us off, I just wanted to ask you, because you mentioned it earlier, I know you guys are a specialist clinic, but is there anything that, because you said that they that people will go to their local clinic first and then come to you if that doesn't work.
What would be your advice for clinics that are looking to implement strategies to support people with body dysmorphia?
The treatment, I think, itself is kind of not too difficult, and most people are trained up in cognitive behavioural therapy. It's just making sure you're doing the right things within the cognitive behavioural therapy, so really working on kind of doing that exposure work and the behavioural experiments is really, really important. And I guess, I mean, fundamentally for me, it's just screening for BDD in the first place, you know, even amongst mental health professionals is so important. So just, you know, really simple questions. So asking people, you know, are they worried about their appearance and preoccupied about it? Are they doing lots of things to try and sort of hide or fix that flaw? And is it causing distress and interference? And just if they say yes, you know, to those, then there's something there. But I guess in terms of treatment, I think where I'm reflecting on where maybe people think they've had treatment for BDD and where it hasn't quite gone to plan or hasn't been how we would say is kind of good quality treatment is just ensuring that somebody is there to see you weekly. Because I think often when there's big gaps, that's really hard to keep the momentum. You know, of course, there'll be an odd week here and there where it's not weekly, but sort of weekly, you know, sort of a good number of sessions as well. So in our service, and we are a specialist service, we offer up to 20 sessions, but we know not all services can do that. Making sure sort of at the beginning of treatment, you're spending time to really understand, you know, the difficulties from the person's perspective. And I think that's really, it sounds really obvious, but I think there's something about BDD where people might be looking at that person, I don't get what they're going on about, because you're looking at their appearance, you know, and you might not quite understand. So, you know, things like I mentioned earlier, just getting somebody to draw themselves if they feel they can, like really getting inside sort of that person's head and understanding what they're seeing and why they're doing that, and being really neutral. I think that's really, really important. So, you know, just not making comments about sort of appearance, staying really neutral and just being alongside somebody and understanding for them this is what they see that is distressing, and they believe that what they're doing as a result of that is warranted. I know that sounds really like, well, a good therapist would do that, but it's actually quite interesting, some of the stories I often hear where people may have said, well, your appearance is fine. It's just those offhand comments can have a real impact on somebody, and it's just being really neutral and sitting alongside somebody in their distress and understanding from their perspective. But I would say the real key is always doing some kind of behavioural experiments and exposure with somebody, always doing it with somebody in the session, so not just talking about it and sending them off to do really hard stuff, but, you know, being alongside them, do it together, go out and try and sort of practice things together in session, and then supporting them to be able to do that in between is really, really important. And then, you know, hopefully if all's gone well and treatment's gone, you know, well and they're better, making sure there's a really robust relapse prevention plan, so like a blueprint that often gets overlooked in treatment. It's so important when somebody's leaving therapy to be that they've got a plan, they know what to do if they have setbacks. It's a long journey, and CBT is there to teach you the tools and the skills and build your confidence in using them, but somebody needs to feel able to do that.
It's really interesting. Thank you for those recommendations. I think they're really, really useful. I think particularly the one about neutral language and not saying to somebody, you know, oh, your appearance is fine. And I think that also translates to loved ones that are supporting somebody with BDD, because I know in the past people have said to me like, oh, well, you know, you've got a fine body, so, you know, how can you possibly be worried about it and stuff? And I know that the intention there is to say to somebody like, you look fine, so don't worry. But when it's eating you up inside and causing you so much distress, you then feel like an idiot, because you're like, well, you know, I'm obviously, you know, you can't see what I can see, or you don't think it's a big you know, you don't think it's a big deal or whatever. So I think, like you say, maybe trying to understand the impact that that's having on somebody, or using very like neutral language as well, I think can be really supportive. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I honestly could carry on talking to you for hours. It's been so lovely. And so thank you so much. This podcast has been so informative and helpful. So I really do appreciate it.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.